As we continue our Blessings of the Fall series, I want to bring us back to the image of a ladder or a staircase with each step or rung being one of the Beatitudes. And I think it's a very helpful image because a good ladder needs all of its rungs, right? Or it's just not what it's supposed to be. And it's the same with the Beatitudes. If we focus only on a couple, the ladder loses its integrity. And we won't be able to ascend, we won't be able to use it to get as high as we should, as God wants us to be. Each blessed that Jesus utters leads to the next. They depend on each other. So as we explore this third beatitude, blessed are the meek, it's critical to remember this. Because when we think of being meek, if I did a poll, I wonder what you'd all say. You know, what do we think of? Maybe gentle, quiet, resigned, reserved, passive. And there's some of that in what Jesus says, but it has to be lived out in connection with the vibrant and robust activity of the other Beatitudes. As we saw last week, mourning isn't some private, resigned, lonely activity done off somewhere by yourself. It's actually a fuel source for addressing injustice. So that spirit comes right before this blessing for the meek, and the rung on the ladder that comes right after it is, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. One of the most intense of Jesus' blessings. The meek hunger for righteousness too, and therefore keep ascending the staircase to the kingdom of heaven. Let's focus on this part for now. To those who have no power, those who have nowhere to turn, no one in their corner, Jesus says, blessed are the meek. The meek are humble. There's that common thread coming out once again. The meek are able to receive direction. And I think that might be the best way to define meek, able to receive right direction. And maybe that's why Moses was called the meekest man on the face of the earth. If we focus on this reference point, humbling oneself to receive right direction, it'll keep us from the common aversion that people have toward the meek, thinking that they're weak. Because that's not the case. In this sense that we're talking about, the meek are not those who cave in to every whim of society, who let themselves be trampled by the boss, who endure cruel abuse at the hands of a dominating spouse. No. They do not allow themselves to be dragged along by the tides of political power or the pressures to vote for a particular candidate. Such rudderless persons have cut themselves off from God's voice in the Beatitudes, the opposite of the meek. The meek hear God's voice to mourn with those who mourn, to hunger and hunt for righteousness, to be pure in heart. Let me quote Presbyterian missionary Kenneth Bailey again. He says this about the Greek word for meek in our verse, praus. Praus means it's the virtue of acting halfway between recklessness on one side and cowardice on the other. The one who is truly meek is the one who becomes angry on the right grounds, against the right party, in the right manner, at the right moment. And the Hebrew meaning behind the word in Jesus' mind tells us to accept the guidance of God and obediently follow the divine will. End quote. That's from his book, Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes. So in short, Jesus is interested in meekness toward God, being directable by God. It's Reformation Sunday, and I tend to quote Martin Luther on this day because, after all, he was the one that nailed those 95 theses on the church door for all to see and got the ball rolling. But if you know much about Martin Luther, meek is probably not a very good word to describe him, because he was an outspoken, unfiltered, passionate, coarse but clever, beer-drinking, argument-wielding German. So instead, let me quote John Calvin, major father of Presbyterian theology. In the preface to his commentary on the Psalms, he talks about his own conversion experience. It's very brief. He was on the path to do something else as a career. He wanted to be a classical humanist scholar, following the spirit of the Renaissance, Then, in the 1530s, something happened to make this aspiring scholar turn into a preacher and a pastor and a theologian. Now, he didn't usually like self-advertisement, so even his description of his conversion is pretty meek. He simply says this, quote, "From so profound an abyss of mire, God subdued me and made me teachable." Made me teachable. Directable by God. A directable meekness is not a handicap, but the opening for God to use us. You don't have to be aggressive to make a relationship with God happen. In fact, you can't make it happen. To know God, to climb that staircase, to live as close as possible to Jesus, you must have what Calvin called a teachable spirit. Jesus did not say, "Blessed are the smart. Blessed are the theologically agile. Blessed are the spiritual giants." No. In fact, let's look at some fictional non-giants as an illustration. Some of you know that I love the world of J.R.R. Tolkien and The Lord of the Rings. In the books and the movies, who are the main characters? Okay, we follow the exploits of these little creatures called hobbits. Okay, they are diminutive little creatures who have no epic ambitions at all. They're childlike in stature, they have a merry nature, and they're content to stay at home in their simple hillside shire. So why do so many people adore them? Why is their ridiculously unlikely triumph over evil so exciting? Well, everyone likes an underdog, right? Kind of like the Cubs and the Indians in the World Series right now. Now, everyone loves an underdog. But it's not just that. It's more than that. Is it maybe an implicit recognition of what's wrong with the way we gawk after what's impressive? Maybe Tolkien makes these little creatures the heroes to challenge our obsession with largeness. For the hobbits, bigger does not always mean better. And small can indeed be beautiful. The hobbits live not in a towering fortress, but in earthen huts. They are not consumers. They give presents to others on their own birthdays. You know, they are uncommonly supportive in friendship, as they must be, because precisely they are small. And I believe God designed something similar for us. Read the scriptures, read Jesus' Beatitudes. I see that this is God's design for us. These hobbits, lacking materialism, they lack lust for power, they're perfect. They're perfect to be the ones to destroy that evil ring of power, because they're the only ones who don't lust after power. You know, they don't want it. This thing that corrupts the big people who pant after it and their desire to be even bigger. Let me quote Tolkien. This is from the first book, The Fellowship of the Ring, of the trilogy anyway. Quote, "The world being full of strange creatures beyond count, these little people seemed of very little importance. But they suddenly became, by no wish of their own, both important and renowned, and troubled the councils of the wise and the great." Sounds a lot like Jesus' beatitude to the meek. This role reversal. Tolkien is mirroring the curious promise of God in the scriptures. Not just the beatitude, but throughout the Bible. The whittling down of Gideon's army from like by 90%. From like 32,000 to like 300 to defeat the Midianites. The choosing of Israel. Now he said, "I didn't choose you because you were great, but because you were the smallest of all nations." The passing over of the impressive sons of Jesse until they get to the last one, the youngest shepherd, little David, who toppled giants. The meek don't mind being weak because their strength is entirely in God. Now, the season of Advent isn't very far away. It's like 1 month away. It starts November 27th. And I was tempted to move this sermon on meekness and just take this beatitude and put it there, because think of Mary, the mother of Jesus. Isn't she the epitome of meekness? her simple, calm life invaded by an unsolicited angelic message, disrupting her plans, creating a scandal, requiring an openness to the unfathomable. And what does she say? Let it be to me according to your word. The epitome of a directable spirit. Paul says in the very first chapter of 1 Corinthians, he says this, "The weakness of God is stronger than men. Consider your call, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise when you were called according to worldly wisdom. Not many of you were strong or powerful. But God chose what is foolish to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised and the things that are not to bring to nothing the things that are. If this be folly, then let's embrace it. As Gandalf the Grey, another hero, one of the friends of the hobbits, said, let folly be our cloak. Blessed are the meek who wear God's folly as their cloak." One of Paul's gravest concerns was our tendency to boast. That's one of the concerns of the reformers too, coming and saying, no, it's not about how much merit we can match with God's. It's not about our righteousness. It's not about our works. It's about the cross. It's about Christ. Author Jim Forrest, he shares a legend about a 4th century monk from Egypt named Macarius. The story goes like this. One day he met up with the devil on the road. The devil attacked him repeatedly, but without success. So he asked, "What is your power, Macarius, that makes me powerless against you? All that you do, I do too. You fast, I too never eat. You keep vigil in the night. I also do not sleep. There's only one thing in which you beat me, as far as I can tell." And Macarius asked what that was. And the devil said, "Your humility. Because of that, I can do nothing against you." This is what I want you to notice. Macarius isn't the one to point it out. He's not the one to declare his secret weapon. He doesn't lift up his spiritual resume and declare, "Well, ye proud spirit, it's because of my great humility." No, Macarius has to ask himself because he's attentive to God, waiting for direction, unfocused on his own self. So, what's the promise of the promise? What is the destiny of Macarius and Mary and David and Moses, the hobbits, if you want to include them, and all of the meek? They will inherit the earth. In essence, Jesus promises a jolting reversal of the haves and the have-nots. And by the way, this is way better than anything Hillary or Trump is proposing. This future grabs our attention so we might pay heed to St. Augustine's warning. You who wish to possess the earth now, take care. If you are meek, you will possess it. If you're ruthless, the earth will possess you. The earth will possess you. Seizing our piece of the pie, whatever that might look like, and it might not just be what we think, like, you know, big corporate greed or the top 1%, or you know what? It might not be like that. It might be closer to home. It might look like trying to lower taxes or trying to get free college education or trying to set up impenetrable borders to keep others off our land. Whatever, think about it. Why do we want these things? Because striving to possess a sizable chunk of earth now is to walk a path of deception and ultimate loss. The possessive will find it all but impossible to avoid being possessed themselves. For then, our possessions will possess us. And our pursuit of a grand inheritance will disinherit us. There's an entire stewardship sermon right there. And that one truth, perfect for this time of year. Don't let your desire for the things of earth now possess you, for then you will not possess the promise Jesus gives to the meek. And what a promise. God will catapult the meek out of the pit to the heights of his kingdom. And the lone good the meek have always pursued will be theirs, proximity to Jesus. When Jesus pledges the earth itself to the meek, it's not like he's planning to divvy it up so each individual gets a slice of the pie, you know, their own little heavenly island off somewhere by themselves. No. A new family is being birthed. The word Jesus uses for meek is plural in the Greek, and I think that's significant. I believe that means the meek will inherit the earth together as one family, not just all alone. But we should expect this of the meek, for they don't advance their own private agendas. They're not competitive. They aren't trying to get ahead of others at the, you know, at their expense. Once again, Jesus promises that the future will reverse the present. Blessed are the meek, all of them, in a new family of mutual deference, humble kindness, and God-directedness. For they will have an experience that even meek Moses never gained in his own lifetime. Entry into the promised land of Jesus. Blessed are the meek. Amen.